and mime strangling herself. I looked away, refusing to be drawn in. Yes, I thought about trying to bag it, but I thought, well, I'll probably be drinking, and taking it back down will be a right pain. What else? I live in Sheffield. I'm a lawyer, but I'm on maternity leave. My husband's looking after Ben today. Ben's our baby. He's... oh, well, you don't want to hear me bore on. He's just lovely. She smiled, a rather worried face lighting up and two deep dimples forming in her cheeks, and I felt a pang at my heart. Not broodiness, I didn't want to be pregnant in any way, shape or form, but a pang for that complete, uncomplicated happiness. "Go on, show us a picky," Tom said. Melanie dimpled again and pulled out her phone. "Well, if you insist. Look, this was when he was born." I saw a picture of her, lying back on a hospital bed, her face bleached to clay colour and her hair in black rat's tails around her shoulders, beaming tiredly down at a white bundle in her arms. I had to look away. "And this is him smiling?" It wasn't his first smile, I didn't catch that, but Bill was away in Dubai, so I made sure I snapped the next one and texted him. "And this is him now. You can't see his face very well. He's got his bowl on his head, bless." The baby was unrecognisable from the angry blue-black stare of the first picture, a chubby, fat-faced little thing crowing with laughter. His face was half obscured by an orange plastic dish, and some kind of green goop was running down his round cheeks. "Bless," Flo said. "He looks just like Bill, doesn't he?"
"Oh, my God." Tom looked half amused, half horrified. "Welcome to parenthood. Please abandon your dry-clean-only clothes at the door."
Melanie tucked her phone away, the smile still on her lips. "It is a bit like that, but it's amazing how quickly you get used to it. It seems completely normal to me now to check my hair for gobs of porridge before I leave the house. Let's not talk about him, anyway. I'm already homesick enough. I don't want to make it worse. What about you, Nina?" She turned to where Nina was sitting beside the stove, hugging her knees. "I remember we met once at Durham, didn't we? Or did I imagine that?"
"No, you're right. I did come up once. I think I was on my way to see a mate at Newcastle. I don't remember meeting Flo, but I definitely remember running into you in the bar. Was that right?"
Melanie nodded.
"For those of you who don't know, I'm Nina. I was at school with Claire and Nora. I'm a doctor. Well, I'm training to be a surgeon, actually. In fact, I just spent 3 months overseas with Médecins Sans Frontières, where I learned a whole lot more than I ever wanted to about gunshot trauma wounds. In spite of what the mail would have you believe, we don't see a whole load of those in Hackney."
She rubbed at her face, and for the first time since we'd left London, I saw her veneer crack a little. I knew Columbia had affected her, but I'd only seen her twice since she came back, and both times she hadn't talked about it, except to make some jokes about the food. For a moment, I got a glimmer of what it might be like to patch people together for a living, and sometimes fail.
"Anyway," she forced a smile. "Tim, Timmy boy, Timbo, shoot."
"Yes," Tom said with a wry look. "Well, I suppose the first thing that you should know about me is that my name is Tom Domer. I am a playwright, as previously advertised. I'm not huge, but I've done a lot of fringe stuff and won a few awards. I'm married to the theatre director Bruce Westerly. Maybe you've heard of him."
There was a pause. Nina was shaking her head. Tom's eye travelled around the circle looking for recognition until it rested hopefully on me. Reluctantly, I gave a little shake. I felt bad, but lying wasn't going to help. He gave a small sigh.
"Oh, well, I guess if you're outside the theatre, maybe you don't notice the director as much. That's how I know Claire, via her work for the Royal Theatre Company. Bruce does quite a bit with them. And he directed Coriolanus, of course."
"Of course," Flo said, nodding earnestly. After my previous failure, I felt I could at least pretend knowledge of this, so I nodded along with Flo, maybe slightly too enthusiastically. I felt my hair tie slip out. Nina yawned and got up to leave the room without a word.
"We live in Camden. We have a dog called Spartacus, Sparky for short. He's a labradoodle, 2 years old. He's completely adorable, but not the ideal dog for a couple of workaholics who travel a lot. Luckily, we have a brilliant dog walker. I'm a vegetarian. What else?"
Oh, dear, that's a terrible indictment, isn't it? 2 minutes and I've run out of interesting things to say about myself. Oh, and I have a tattoo of a heart on my shoulder blade. That's it. How about you, Nora?
For some unfathomable reason, I felt myself flush scarlet, and my fingers lost their grip on the teacup, slopping tea onto my knee. I busied myself wiping it up with the corner of my scarf, and then looked up to find Nina had slipped back inside. She was holding her tobacco pouch and rolling up with one hand, watching me steadily with her wide, dark eyes as she did. I forced myself to speak. Not much to tell. I met Claire at school, like Nina. We haven't spoken for 10 years. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why I'm here. I swallowed painfully. We lost touch a bit, I guess. My face felt hot. The stove was really starting to throw out heat. I went to tuck my hair behind my ears, but I'd forgotten it had been cut, and my fingers only skimmed the short strands, my skin warm and damp beneath. I'm a writer. I went to UCL, and I started work at a magazine after university, but I was pretty crap at it. Probably my own fault. I spent all my time scribbling my novel instead of doing research and making contacts. Anyway, I sold my first book when I was 22, and I've been a full-time writer ever since.
And you support yourself entirely on your books?
Tom raised an eyebrow.
Respect?
Well, not entirely. I mean, I do the odd bit of online teaching here and there, editorial reports and stuff. And I was lucky.
Lucky? I wanted to bite my tongue.
Well, maybe not lucky, that's not the right word, but my granddad died when I was in my teens, and I got some money, enough for a tiny studio flat in Hackney. It's absolutely minuscule, only room for me and my laptop, but I don't have any rent to pay.
I think it's really nice that you've all kept in touch, Tom said. You and Claire and Nina, I mean. I don't think I've kept in contact with any of my friends from school. I've got nothing in common with most of them. It wasn't the happiest time for me.
He looked at me steadily, and I felt myself flush. I went to tuck my hair again, and then dropped my hand. Was it my imagination, or was there something slightly malicious in his gaze? Did he know something? I struggled for a moment, wanting to answer, but not sure what I could say that wasn't an outright lie. As I floundered, the silence growing more uncomfortable by the second, the wrongness of this whole situation struck me all over again. What the hell was I doing here? 10 years. 10 years.
I think everyone has a shit time at school, Nina said at last, breaking the pause.
I certainly did.
I looked at her gratefully, and she gave me a little wink.
What's the secret, then?
Tom asked.
To long-lived friendships. How have you managed to keep it up all these years?
I looked at him again, sharply this time. Why the hell couldn't he just let it drop? But there was nothing I could say, not without looking like a crazy person.
I don't know, I said at last, trying to keep my voice pleasant, but I could feel the strain in my smile.
I could only pray that my expression wasn't as obviously fake as it felt.
Luck, I guess. Significant others? Melanie asked.
No, just me. Not even a labradoodle. It was meant to raise a laugh, and they duly did, but it was a thin, lacklustre chorus with a pitying note.
Flo,
I said quickly, trying to get the spotlight off myself. Flo beamed.
Well, I met Claire at university. We were both studying history of art, and we got allocated to the same halls of residence. I walked into the common room, and there she was, sitting in front of EastEnders, chewing her hair. You know that funny way she's got of twisting a lock around her finger and nibbling on it? So sweet.
I tried to remember. Had Claire ever done this? It sounded disgusting. A faint memory came of Claire sitting in the cafe next to the school, twisting her plait around her finger. Maybe she had.
She was wearing that blue dress. I think she's still got it.
Can't believe she fits into it. I've put on at least a stone since uni. Anyway, I went up and said hi, and she said, oh, I like your scarf, and we've been BFFs ever since. She's just great, you know? She's been such an inspiration, so supportive. There's not many people who...
She gulped and broke off, struggling, and to my horror, I saw she was welling up.
Well, anyway, never mind all that. She's my rock, and I'd do anything for her. Anything. I just want her to have the best hen night ever, you know? I want it to be perfect. It means everything to me. It's like the last thing I can do for her, you know?
There were tears in her eyes, and she spoke with an intensity so fierce it was almost frightening. Looking around the circle, I saw that I wasn't the only one taken aback. Tom looked frankly startled, and Nina's eyebrows had disappeared beneath her fringe. Only Melanie looked totally unconcerned, as if this was a normal level of emotion to feel for your best friend.
"She's getting married, not going to prison," Nina said dryly,
but either Flo didn't hear or she ignored the remark. Instead, she coughed and swiped at her eyes.
"Sorry. Oh, God, I'm such a sentimental moo. Look at me."
"And, what do you do now?"
Tom asked politely. As he said it, I realized Flo had told us entirely about Claire and almost nothing about herself.
"Oh," Flo looked down at the floor. "Well, you know, a bit of this, a bit of that. I took some time out after uni. I wasn't in a good place. Claire was amazing. When I was... Well, never mind that. The thing is, she's just the best friend a girl could have. Honestly. God, look at me."
She blew her nose and stood up.
"Who's for more tea?"
We all shook our heads, and she picked up the tray and went through to the kitchen. Melanie took out her phone and checked the signal again.
"Well, that was weird," Nina said flatly.
"What?"
Melanie looked up.
"Flo and the quote-unquote perfect hen," Nina spelled out. "Don't you think she's a little intense?"
"Oh," Melanie said.
She glanced out of the door towards the kitchen and then lowered her voice.
"Look, I don't know if I should be saying this, but there's no sense in beating around the bush. Flo had a bit of a breakdown in her third year. I'm not sure what happened, but she dropped out before her finals. She never graduated, as far as I know, so that's why she's a bit, you know, sensitive about that period. She doesn't really like discussing it."
Okay,
Nina said, but I knew what she was thinking. What had been alarming about Flo wasn't her reserve about what happened after uni. That was the least odd part of the whole thing. It was everything else that had been unnerving. Chapter 5. I want to sleep, but they shine lights in my eyes. They test and scan and print me and take away my clothes stiff with blood. What's happened? What have I done? I'm wheeled down long corridors, their lights dimmed for night, past wards of sleeping patients. Some of them wake as I pass, and I can see my state reflected in their shocked expressions, in the way they turn their faces away, as from something pitiable or horrifying. The doctors ask me questions I can't answer, tell me things I can't remember. And at last I am hooked up to a monitor and left, drugged and bleary and alone. But not quite alone. I turn painfully onto my side, and that's when I see, through the wire-hatched glass of the door, is a policewoman sitting patiently on a stool. I'm being guarded, but I don't know why. I lie there, staring through the glass at the back of the police officer's head. I want so badly to go out there and ask questions, but I don't dare. Partly because I'm not sure if my woolly legs will carry me to the door, but partly because I am not sure if I can bear the answers. I lie for what feels like a long time, listening to the hum of the equipment and the click of the morphine syringe driver. The pain in my head and legs dulls and becomes distant. And then, at last, I sleep. I dream of blood, spreading and pooling and soaking me. I am kneeling in the blood, trying to stop it, but I can't. It soaks my pajamas. It spreads across the bleached wood floor. And that's when I wake up. For a second, I just lie there with my heart pounding in my chest and my eyes adjusting to the dim night lights of the room. I have a raging thirst and a pain in my bladder. There's a plastic cup on the locker just by my head, and with a huge effort I reach out and hook one trembling finger around the rim, pulling it towards myself. It tastes flat and plasticky, but my God, drinking never felt so good. I drain it dry, and then let my head flop back on the pillow with a jar that sets stars dancing in the dim light. For the first time, I realize there are leads coming out from under the sheets, connecting me to some kind of monitor, its flickering screen sending dim green shadows across the room. One of the leads is attached to my finger on my left hand, and when I lift it up, I see to my surprise that my hand is scratched and bloodied, and my already bitten nails are broken. I remember a car. I remember stumbling across broken glass. One of my shoes had come off. Beneath the sheets, I rub my feet together, feeling the pain in one and the swollen bulge of a dressing on the other. And across my shins, I can feel the stretch and pull of some kind of surgical tape across one leg. It's only when my hand strays to my shoulder, my right shoulder, that I wince and look down. There's a vast spreading bruise coming out from beneath the hospital gown, running down my arm. When I shrug my shoulder out of the neckline, I can see a mass of purple blooming out from a dark, swollen center just above my armpit. What could make such an odd, one-sided bruise? I feel like the memory is hovering just beyond my fingertips, but it remains stubbornly out of reach. Have I had an accident? A car accident? Was I attacked? Painfully, I slide my hand beneath the sheets and run my palm across my belly, my breasts, my side. My arms are slashed with cuts, but my body seems okay. I put my hand to my thighs, feel between my legs. There's some kind of thick nappy thing, but no pain, no cuts, no bruises on the inside of my thighs. Whatever happened, it wasn't that. I lie back and shut my eyes, tired, tired of trying to remember, tired of being afraid. And the syringe driver clicks and whirs, and suddenly nothing seems as important anymore. It is just as I'm drifting off to sleep that an image comes to me. A shotgun hanging on a wall. And suddenly I know. The bruise is a recoil bruise. At some point in the recent past, I have fired a gun. Chapter 6 Flo? I stuck my head around the kitchen door. Flo was loading the dishwasher with cups.
You shouldn't be doing that all by yourself. Can I help?
No, don't be silly, it's done. She slammed the dishwasher shut.
What is it? Anything I can help with? I'm so sorry about the coffee.
What?
Oh, honestly, it's fine.
Listen, what time did you say Claire was due to get here?
About 6, I think.
She looked up at the kitchen clock.
So we've got an hour and a half to kill.
Okay, well, I was just wondering, have I got time to go for a quick run?
A run? She looked startled.
Well, I guess, but it's getting dark.
Oh, I won't go far, it's just... I shifted awkwardly. I couldn't explain it to her. I have trouble explaining it to myself, but I had to get out, get away. I run almost every day at home. I have about 4 different routes. Variations going through Victoria Park in fine weather, or street runs when it's wet or dark. I give myself a couple of days off a week. They say you should, to let your muscles repair. But sooner or later the need builds up, and then I have to run. If I don't, I get, I don't know what you'd call it, cabin fever, maybe. A kind of claustrophobia. I hadn't run yesterday. I'd been too busy packing and tying up loose ends. And now I felt a powerful itch to get out of this box-like house. It's not about the physical exercise, or at least it's not only that. I've tried running in a gym, on a treadmill, and it's not the same. It's about getting out, not having walls around myself, being able to get away.
I guess you've got time, Flo said,
glancing out the window at the deepening twilight.
But you'd better be quick. When it gets dark here, it gets really, really dark.
I'll be quick. Is there a route I should go for?
I think your best bet would be to take the forest path down.
Hang on, come into the living room.
She led me through and pointed out of the huge window wall to a shadowy gap in the forest.
See, that's a footpath. It leads down through the wood to the main road. It'll be firmer and less muddy than the drive, much easier to run. You just follow it down until you hit tarmac. But then I'd turn right along the main road and come back up the drive. It'll be too dark by then to run back through the forest. The path isn't fenced, and you could end up going in totally the wrong direction.
Hang on. She went back to the kitchen, rummaged in a drawer, and pulled out something that looked like a set of badly folded suspenders.
Take this. It's a head torch.
I thanked her and hurried up to my room to pull on my running gear and trainers. Nina was lying on her bed looking at the ceiling and listening to something on her iPhone.
That Flo's quite the Fruit Loop, isn't she? She said conversationally as I came in, pulling out her earphones.
Is that a medical term, Dr. D'Souza?
Yes, from the Latin frutus lupus, fruit of the moon, associated with the pagan belief that insanity was connected to bathing in the light of the full moon.
I began laughing as I pulled off my jeans and yanked on my thermal running leggings and top.
Lupus is Latin for wolf. You're thinking of Luna.
Where are my trainers? I left them by the door.
I chucked them under the bed.
Anyway, werewolves turn crazy at the full moon. Same diff.
Speaking of crazy, are you going out?
Yes.
I bent to look under the bed. There were my trainers, miles underneath. Thanks, Nina. I knelt and began fishing with my arm, my voice muffled by the bedclothes as I asked,
why?
Let me see.
She began ticking off the reasons on her fingers.
It's dark. You don't know the neighbourhood. There's free wine and food downstairs.
Oh, and did I mention it's pitch fucking black outside?
It's not pitch black.
I looked out of the window as I tied my trainer laces. It was pretty dark, but it wasn't pitch black. The sun had set, but the sky was clear and still illuminated by a diffuse, pearly grey light in the west, and a round white moon rising from the trees in the east.
And it's going to be a full moon, so it won't be that dark.
Oh, really? Miss Leonora, I've lived in London for the past 8 years and never strayed more than 50 yards from a street lamp in all that time, sure.
Really?
I double-knotted the trainers and stood up straight.
Don't give me grief, Nina. I've got to get out or I really will go crazy, moon or no moon.
Huh, you're finding it that bad?
No.
But I was. I couldn't explain why. I couldn't tell Nina how it had made me feel, having strangers picking over my past with Claire downstairs, like someone picking at the edges of a half-healed wound. I'd made a mistake in coming. I knew that now. But I was stuck here, carless, until Nina chose to go.
No, I'm fine. I just want to get out. Now. See you in an hour.
I set off down the stairs with her mocking laugh following me as I slammed out the door.
You can run, but you can't escape.
Out in the forest, I took a breath of the clean, crisp air and began to warm up. I stretched my limbs against the garage, looking out into the forest. The sense of menace, nearing claustrophobia, that I'd had inside had gone. Was it the glass? The feeling that anyone could be out there looking in and we'd never know it? Or was it the strange anonymity of the rooms that made me think of social experiments, of hospital waiting rooms? Out here, I realized, the sense of being watched had quite gone. I began to run. It was easy. This was easy. No questions, no one prodding and poking, just the sharp, sweet air and the soft thud of my feet on the carpet of pine needles. It had rained a fair bit, but the water could not sit on this soft, loose-draining soil the way it could on the compacted, rutted drive, and there were few puddles or even boggy bits, just miles of clean, springy pathway, the drifted needles of a thousand trees beneath the soles of my shoes. There are no other runners in my family, or not that I know of, but my grandmother was a walker. She said that when she was a girl, and in a rage with a friend, she used to write their name on the soles of her feet in chalk and walk until the name was gone. She said by the time the chalk had worn away, her resentment would have faded too. I don't do that, but I hold a mantra in my head and I run until I can't hear it anymore, above the pounding of my heart and the pounding of my feet. Tonight, although I wasn't angry at her, or at least not any more, I could hear my heart beating out her name. Claire, 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 Claire. Down, down through the woods I ran, through the gathering dark and the soft night sounds. I saw bats swooping in the gloaming, and the sound of animals breaking from shelter. A fox shot across the path ahead and then stopped, superbly arrogant, his slim-nosed head following my scent as I thumped past in the quiet dusk. This was easy, the downhill swoop, like flying through the twilight. And I didn't feel afraid, in spite of the darkness. Out here, the trees weren't silent watchers behind the glass, but friendly presences, welcoming me into the wood, parting before me as I ran, swift and barely panting, along the forest path. It would be the uphill stretch that tested me, the run back along the rutted, muddy drive, and I knew I must make it to the drive before it got so dark that I could not see the potholes. And so I ran harder, pushing myself. I had no time to keep, no target to make. I didn't even know the distance. But I knew what my legs could do, and I kept my stride long and loose. I leapt over a fallen log, and for a minute I shut my eyes, crazy in this dim light, and I could almost imagine that I was flying and would never meet the ground. At last I could see the road, a pale grey snake in the deepening shadows. As I broke out from the woods, I heard the soft hoot of an owl, and I obeyed Flo's instructions, turning right along the tarmac. I hadn't been running for long when I heard the sound of a car behind me and stopped, pressing myself up against the verge. I had no wish to be run down by someone not expecting to find a runner out at this time. The sound of the car came closer, brutally loud in the quiet night, and then it was upon me, the engine roaring like a chainsaw. My eyes were dazzled by the blinding headlights, and then it was gone, into the darkness, only the red of its rear lights showing like ruby eyes in the darkness, backing away. Its passing had left me blinking and night-blind, and even though I waited, hoping my eyes would readjust, the night seemed infinitely darker than a few moments ago, and I was suddenly afraid of running into the ditch at the side of the road or tripping on a branch. I felt in my pocket for Flo's head torch and wrestled it on. It felt awkward, tight enough for the clip to dig in, but loose enough for me to worry about it falling off as I started up again. At least now I could see the patch of tarmac in front of me, the white markings at the side of the road glittering back at me in the torch beam. A break on the right showed me that I was at the drive, and I slowed and turned the corner. Now I was grateful for the head torch, and it was not a matter of running anymore, but a sort of slow, cautious jog, picking my way around muddy troughs and avoiding the potholes that might break an unwary ankle. Even so, my trainers were caked, and every step felt like I was dragging a brick, half a pound of clotted mud on the sole of each shoe. I'd have fun cleaning them when I got back. I tried to remember how far it was. Half a mile? I kind of wished I'd gone back through the wood, dark or no dark. But far up ahead I could see the beacon of the house, its blank glass walls shining golden in the night. The mud sucked at my feet, as if trying to keep me here in the dark, and I gritted my teeth and forced my tired legs to go a bit faster. I was maybe halfway when there was a sound from below, back on the main road, a car slowing down. I didn't have a watch, and I'd left my phone back at the house, but surely it couldn't be 6 yet. I hadn't been running for an hour, nothing like it. But there it was, the sound of an engine idling as the car made the turn, and then a gritting, growling roar as it began to plough up the hill, bouncing from pothole to pothole. I flattened myself against the hedge as it got closer, and stood shielding my eyes from the glare and hoping that the car wouldn't splash me with too much mud as it passed. But to my surprise, it stopped, its exhaust a cloud of white against the moon, and I heard the whir of an electric window and a blast of Beyoncé, quickly muffled as someone turned the volume down. I took a step closer, my heart pounding again, as if I'd been running much faster than I had. The head torch had been angled to point at the ground, for walking rather than talking, and I couldn't work out how to adjust it back up. Instead, I pulled the apparatus from my head, holding it in my hand, and shone it into the pale face of the girl in the car. But I didn't need to. I knew who it was. Claire.
Lee?
She said, as if in disbelief. The light was full in her eyes, and she blinked and shielded them from the torch beam.
My God, is it really you? I didn't... What are you doing here?
Chapter 7. For a minute, I didn't understand. Had there been some horrible mistake? Was it possible she hadn't invited me at all, and this was all Flo's stupid idea?
I'm your hen,
I stammered. Didn't you?
I know that, silly.
She laughed, a nervous gust of white breath in the cold air.
I meant, what are you doing out here? Are you training for an Arctic expedition or something?
Having a run, I said, trying to make it sound like the most normal thing in the world. It's not that cold, just a bit nippy. But I was cold now, standing still, and I ruined the last words by shivering convulsively.
Get in. I'll give you a lift up to the house.
She leaned across and opened the passenger door.
My trainers, they're pretty gross. Don't worry, it's a hire car. Get in already before we both freeze.
I squelched round to the passenger side and got in, feeling the heat of the car strike through my cold, sweat-soaked thermals. The mud had penetrated my trainers. My toes were squishing inside the lining in a way that made me shudder. Claire put the car back into gear and hushed single ladies with a click of the mute button. The silence was suddenly deafening.
So,
she looked at me sideways. She was just as beautiful as ever. I'd been crazy to think 10 years could have made a difference to Claire. Her beauty was bone deep. Even in the dim light of the car, muffled up in an old hoodie and a giant snood-like scarf, she looked startling. Her hair was piled on top of her head in an adorably messy knot that spilled down over her shoulders. Her nails were painted scarlet, but chipped, not try-hard, no one could accuse Claire of that. Pitch perfect, more like. So, I echoed back. I had always felt like the poor relation in comparison to Claire. 10 years had changed nothing, I realized.
Long time no see.
She was shaking her head, her fingertips tapping on the wheel.
But God, I mean, it's good to see you, Lee, you know?
I said nothing. I wanted to tell her I was not that person anymore. I was Nora now, not Lee. I wanted to tell her it wasn't her fault. The reason I hadn't kept in touch was nothing to do with her, that it was me. Only, that wasn't completely true. Most of all, I wanted to ask her why I was here. But I didn't. I didn't say anything. I just sat, staring up at the house as we wound closer.
It's really good to see you, she said again. So you're a writer now, is that right?
Yes, I said. The words seemed strange and false in my mouth, as if I were lying or telling stories about someone else, a distant relative, perhaps. Yes, I'm a writer. I write crime fiction.
I heard. I saw a piece in the paper. I'm really pleased for you. That's amazing, you know. You should be very proud.
I shrugged. It's just a job. The words came out stiff and bitter. I didn't mean them like that. I know I'm lucky, and I worked hard to get here. I should be proud. I am proud. What about you? I managed.
I'm in PR. I work for the Royal Theatre Company.
PR, that figured, and I smiled, a genuine smile this time. Claire was always amazing at spinning a story, even at 12, even at 5.
I'm very happy, she said softly. And listen, I'm sorry we lost touch. Seeing you, we had some good times, didn't we?
She glanced at me in the ghostly green light from the dashboard.
Remember having our first fag together? She gave a laugh. First kiss, first joint, first time sneaking into an 18 film.
First time getting chucked out, I retorted, and then wished I hadn't sounded so snide. Why? Why was I being so defensive? But Claire only laughed.
What a humiliation. We thought we were being so clever, getting Rick to buy the tickets and sneaking through to the loos. I didn't think they'd check at the screen door as well.
Rick! I'd forgotten him. What's he up to these days?
God knows. Probably in prison, for underage sex, if there's any justice.
Rick had been Claire's boyfriend for a year when we were 14 or 15, a greasy, long-haired 22-year-old with a motorbike and a gold tooth. I'd never liked him. Even at 14, I'd found it bizarre and disgusting that Claire would want to sleep with a bloke that age, despite the fact that he could get into clubs and buy alcohol. Ugh, he was such a creep, I said before I thought better of it. I bit my tongue, but Claire only laughed.
Totally. I can't believe I couldn't see it at the time. I thought I was so sophisticated having sex with an older guy. Now it seems like one step away from paedophilia.
She gave a snort and then an exclamation as the car bounced off a pothole.
Oops, sorry.
There was silence for a while as she negotiated the last and most rutted part of the drive, and then we swung onto the gravelled space at the front of the house, tucking in neatly between Nina's hire car and Flo's Land Rover. Claire turned off the engine, and for a minute we just sat in the dark car, contemplating the house, with the players inside ranged like actors on a stage, just as Tom had said. There was Flo, beavering away in the kitchen, bending over the oven. Melanie was hunched over the phone in the living room. Tom sprawled across a sofa directly opposite the plate glass window, flicking through a magazine. Nina was nowhere to be seen, out having a fag on the balcony, most likely. Why am I here? I thought again, with a kind of agony this time. Why did I come? Then Claire turned to me, her face lit by the golden light streaming from the house.
Lee?
She said at the same time as I said, look.
What?
She asked. I shook my head.
No, you go first. No, you. Honestly, it wasn't important.
My heart was beating painfully in my chest, and suddenly I couldn't ask it any more, the question on the tip of my tongue. Instead, I forced out,
I'm not Lee anymore.
I'm Nora.
What?
My name. I don't go by Lee anymore. I never liked it.
Oh.
She was silent, digesting this.
Okay, so it's Nora now, huh?
Yes.
Well, I'll do my best to remember. It's going to be hard, though, after, 21 years of knowing you as Lee?
But you never knew me, I thought involuntarily, and then frowned. Of course Claire had known me. She'd known me since I was 5. That was exactly the problem. She knew me too well. She saw through the thin adult veneer to the scrawny, frightened child beneath.
Why, Claire?
I said suddenly, and she looked up, her face blank and pale in the darkness.
Why what?
Why am I here?
Oh, God.
She looked down at her hands.
I knew you'd ask that. I suppose you wouldn't believe me if I said Auld Lang Syne and all that.
I shook my head.
It's not that, is it? You had 10 years to make contact if you wanted to. Why now?
Because... She took a deep breath, and I was astonished to realise that she was nervous. It was hard to process. I'd never seen her anything less than totally self-possessed, even aged 5. She'd had a stare that could make the most hardened teacher melt or wilt, whichever she chose. It was, I suppose, why we'd been friends in a strange way. She had what I craved, that all-encompassing self-possession. Even standing in her shadow, I'd felt stronger, but not any more.
Because, she said again, and I saw her chipped, lacquered nails glint, red as blood, as her fingers twisted together and her nails caught the light from the house and reflected it back into the car.
Because I thought you deserved to know. Deserved to be told, face to face.
I promised myself I'd do it to your face.
What? I leaned forward. I wasn't frightened, only puzzled. I'd forgotten my stained wet shoes and the stench of sweat on my clothes. I'd forgotten everything apart from this. Claire's worried face, filled with an edgy vulnerability I'd never seen before.
It's about the wedding, she said. She looked down at her hands. It's about who I'm marrying.
Who? I said. And then, to make her laugh, to try to break the tension that was filling the car and infecting me, I said,
It's not Rick, is it?
I always knew.
No,
she broke in, meeting my eyes at last. And there was not a shred of laughter there, only a kind of steely determination, as if she were about to do something unpleasant but utterly necessary.
No. It's James.
Chapter 8.
For a moment, I stared at her, willing myself to have misheard.
What? It's James. I'm marrying James.
I said nothing. I sat, staring out at the sentinel trees, hearing the blood in my ears hiss and pound. Something was building inside me like a scream, but I said nothing. I pushed it back down.
James? Claire and James? That's why I asked you.
She was speaking fast now, as though she knew she didn't have much time, that I might get up and bolt from the car.
I thought I shouldn't invite you to the wedding. I thought it would be too hard, but I couldn't bear for you to hear it from somewhere else.
But then who the hell is William Pilgrim?
It burst out of me like an accusation. For a second, Claire looked at me blankly. Then she realized, and her face changed. And at the same second, I knew where I'd heard that name before, and realized how stupid I'd been. Billy Pilgrim. Slaughterhouse-Five. James's favourite book.
It's his Facebook name, I said dully. For privacy. So fans don't find his personal profile when they search. That's why he doesn't have a profile picture, right?
Claire nodded wretchedly.
I never meant to mislead you, she said pleadingly.
She reached her warm hand out towards my numb, mud-splattered one.
And James thought you should know before...
Wait a minute. I pulled my hand away abruptly.
You talked to him about this?
She nodded and put her hands to her face.
Lee, I'm so...
She stopped and took a deep breath, and I got the feeling she was marshalling herself, working out what to say next. When she spoke again, it was with a trace of defiance, a flicker of the Claire I remembered. Who would have attacked, who would have died fighting rather than lie down under an accusation.
Look, I won't apologize. Neither of us have done anything wrong. But please, won't you give us your blessing?
If you haven't done anything wrong, my voice was hard. Why do you need it?
Because you were my friend. My best friend.
Were. We both registered the past tense at the same time, and I saw my own reaction reflected in Claire's face. I bit my lip so hard that it hurt, crushing the soft skin between my teeth. You have my blessing. Say it. Say it. There was a sound from the house. The door opened, and there was Flo standing in the rectangle of light, shading her eyes as she looked out into the darkness. She was standing on the tips of her toes, almost toppling as she craned to see. And there was an air of suppressed excitement about her, like a child before a birthday party who might tip over into hysteria at any moment.
Hello!
She called, her voice shockingly loud in the still night air.
Claire? Is that you?
Claire let out a trembling breath and opened the car door.
Flopsy!
Her voice shook, but almost imperceptibly. I thought, not for the first time, what an amazing actress she was. It was not surprising she'd ended up in theatre. The only surprise was that she wasn't on stage herself.
Claire Bear!
Flo shrieked and catapulted down the steps onto the gravel. Oh my God, it is you! I heard a noise and thought, but then no one came. She was stumbling hastily down the path in front of the house, her bunny slippers shushing in the grit.
What are you doing out here in the dark all by yourself, you silly moo?
I was talking to Lee. I mean, Nora.
Claire waved a hand at my side of the car.
I ran into her on the way up the drive.
Not literally, I hope.
What?
There was a crunch as Flo tripped over something in the dark and fetched up on her knees in front of the car with a rush. She jumped up, brushing herself down.
I'm fine! I'm fine!
Calm down, Claire laughed and hugged Flo. She whispered something into her hair that I didn't hear, and Flo nodded. I pulled at the door handle and got stiffly out of the car. It had been a mistake not to walk those last few yards up to the house. Going from running to sitting so abruptly, my muscles had seized up. Now it was an effort to straighten.
You're all right, Lee?
Claire said, turning back at the sound of me getting out.
You look like you're hobbling a bit.
I'm fine.
I tried to match her in keeping my voice light. James.
James.
Want a hand with your bags?
Thanks, but I've not got much.
She popped the boot and picked up her shoulder bag.
Come on then, Flo, show us my room.
Nina was nowhere to be seen when I climbed the last painful step up to our room, holding my muddy trainers by the laces. I peeled off my spattered leggings and sweaty top and crawled under the duvet in my bra and knickers. There I lay, staring into the pool of light cast by the bedside lamp. This had been a mistake. What had I been thinking of? I'd spent 10 years trying to forget James, trying to build a chrysalis of assurance and self-sufficiency around myself, and I'd thought I was succeeding. I had a good life. No, I had a great life. I had a job I loved. I had my own flat. I had some lovely friends, none of whom knew James or Claire or anyone else from my former life in Reading. I was beholden to no one, emotionally, financially, or in any other way. And that made me feel fine. Absolutely fucking fine, thanks very much. And now this. The worst of it was, I couldn't blame Claire. She was right. She and James had done nothing wrong. They didn't owe me anything, either of them. James and I had broken up over a decade ago, for Christ's sake. No. The only person I could blame was myself. For not moving on. For not being able to move on. I hated James for his hold over me. I hated that every time I met a man, I was comparing them in my head. The last time I slept with someone, 2 years ago, he had woken me in the night, his hand on my chest.
You were having a dream, he said. Who's James?
And when he saw my stricken face, he'd swung his legs out of bed, got up, got dressed, and walked out of my life. And I never even bothered to phone him back. I hated James. And I hated myself. And yes, I am fully aware that this makes me sound like the biggest loser in existence. The girl who meets a boy aged 16 and obsesses over him for the next 10 bloody years. Believe me, no one is more aware of that than me. If I met myself in a bar and got talking, I would despise myself too. I could hear the others downstairs talking and laughing, and caught the smell of pizza floating up the stairs. I was going to have to go down there and talk and laugh too. Instead, I curled myself into a ball, my knees to my chest, my eyes tight shut, and I screamed a silent scream inside my head. Then I straightened, feeling my tired muscles protest, got out of bed and picked up the topmost towel off the pile Flo had stacked carefully on the foot of each bed. The bathroom was on the landing, and I locked the door and let the towel drop to the floor. Over the bath was another uncurtained plate glass window, looking out over the forest in an incredibly unnerving way. It was angled so that, in practice, you wouldn't be able to see inside the room unless you were perched on top of a 50-foot pine. But as I took off my bra and knickers, I had to fight the urge to cross my hands over my breasts, covering my nakedness from the watchful darkness. For a minute, I considered getting straight into my change of clothes. But I was tired and mud-spattered, and I knew I'd feel better if I had a hot shower. So I climbed carefully into the walk-in enclosure and turned the lever, stretching gratefully as the huge showerhead coughed twice and then flooded me with an enormous, forceful gush of hot water. Standing like this, I could look out at the window, though it was too dark to see much. The bright bathroom light turned the glass into a sort of mirror, and aside from a pale, ghostly moon, all I could see was my own body reflected in the fast, steaming glass as I soaped and shaved my legs. What kind of person was Flo's aunt, anyway? This was a house for voyeurs. No, that was people who liked to watch. What was the opposite? Exhibitionists. People who liked to be seen. Perhaps it was different in summer, when the light came flooding in until late into the evening. Perhaps then it was a house for looking out of, across the forest. But now, in the dark, it felt like the reverse. It felt like a glass display case full of curiosities to be peered at, or a cage in a zoo, a tiger's enclosure with nowhere to hide. I thought of those caged animals pacing slowly backwards and forwards, day after day, week after week, going slowly crazy. When I was finished, I climbed carefully out and peered at myself in the steam-misted mirror, swiping away the condensation with my hand. The face that looked back at me startled me. It looked like someone ready for a fight. It was partly my short hair. After my shower and a rough dry with the towel, it looked aggressively spiky and defiant, like a boxer's between rounds. My face was white and stark under the bright lights, my eyes dark and accusing, and surrounded by shadows, like I'd taken a beating. I sighed and got out my wash bag. I don't wear much makeup, but I had lip gloss and mascara, the basics. No blusher, but I rubbed a bit of lip gloss into my cheekbones in an effort to brighten the pallor, then yanked on clean skinny jeans and a grey top. From somewhere far below, music started up. Billy Idol, by the sounds of it, White Wedding. Someone's idea of a joke.
Nora!
Flo's voice floated up the stairs above the sound of Billy Idol telling us to start again.
Are you ready for something to eat?
Coming, I shouted back, and with a sigh, I bundled my dirty underwear into my towel, picked up my wash bag, and opened the door. Chapter 9. While I had been in the shower, the hen night had started in earnest. In the living room, Tom and Claire had plugged in someone's iPhone and were dancing round the coffee table to Billy Idol, while Melanie laughed at them from the sofa. In the kitchen, which was hot as hell from the overworked oven, I could see someone shoveling industrial quantities of pizza onto boards and dumping various tubs of dip into bowls. For a disorienting minute, I thought it was Claire. They were wearing the same grey jeans and silver vest that Claire had been wearing next door. Then she stood up and wiped the hair off her forehead, and I saw it was Flo. She was wearing exactly the same clothes as Claire. Before I could pick that apart any further, my thoughts were interrupted by a strong smell of charring. "Is something burning?" I asked.
"Oh, my God! The pitters!"
Flo shrieked.
"Lee, can you rescue them before they set the alarm off?"
I ran across the rapidly smoke-filling kitchen and grabbed the pitter breads from the toaster before dumping them in the sink. Then I set about wrestling with the door at the far end of the kitchen. It was locked, and there was a trick to the handle, but finally I managed to fling it wide open. Freezing air gusted in, and I saw to my surprise that the puddles on the lawn were frosting over.
"I've looked in the wine rack, and I can't find any tequila."
Nina's voice came from the doorway, and then,
"Bloody hell, it's freezing! Shut the door, you mentalist!"
"The pitters were burning," I said mildly, but I swung the door shut. At least the temperature in the room was closer to normal now.
"It's not in the cellar?"
Flo straightened up, brushing sweaty hair out of her eyes. Her face was scarlet from the heat.
"Blast! Where on earth could it be?"
"You tried the fridge?"
Nina asked. Flo nodded.
"Freezer?"
I asked. She clapped her hand to her forehead.
"Freezer! Of course! I remember now thinking it'd be better if we wanted frozen margaritas. Oh, I'm such an idiot!"
"Amen," Nina mouthed at me as she bent and opened the freezer under the counter.
"Here it is."
Her voice came slightly muffled by the whir of the freezer fan. She straightened up, a frosted bottle in her hand, and scooped up two limes from the fruit bowl.
"Nora, grab a board and a knife. Oh, and the salt shaker. Flo, did you say there were shot glasses through there?"
"Yep, behind the mirror door at the end of the living room. But do you think we should start with shots? Wouldn't it be more sensible to start with a cooler first, like mojitos, maybe?"
"Screw sensible," Nina said as she left the kitchen. And then, under her breath to me as we crossed the hall, "I need something as strong as possible to get me through this."
As we entered the living room, Claire and Tom turned, and Claire gave a whoop and danced over to take the bottle from Nina's hand and the knife from mine. She shimmied back to the coffee table, her top scattering motes of light around the dimly lit room as she banged them both down on the glass with a crack.
"Tequila slammers! I haven't done these since my 21st. I think it's taken this long for the hangover to wear off."
Nina let the limes bounce onto the table alongside the rest, and then turned to hunt in the cupboard for glasses, while Claire knelt on the rug and started slicing.
"Hen first,"
Melanie said, and Claire grinned. We all watched as she shook a pinch of salt into the hollow of her wrist and picked up a chunk of lime. Nina filled a shot glass to the teetering brim and pushed it into her hand. Claire licked her wrist, gulped the shot, and bit hard into the lime, her eyes squeezed shut. Then she spat it out onto the rug and slammed the shot glass down on the tabletop, shuddering and laughing at the same time.
"Jesus! Oh, my God, my eyes are watering. My mascara will be halfway down my face if I have any more."
"Lady," Nina said sternly,
"we are just getting started. Nora, next."
"You know,"
Tom said as I knelt at the table,
"if you want something a bit more upmarket,
we could have tequila royales."
"Tequila royales?"
I watched as Nina overfilled the tiny glass, liquor splashing down and puddling on the glass tabletop.
"What's that, champagne?"
"Possibly, but not the way I make them."
Tom dug in his trouser pocket and held up a little bag of white powder.
"Something a bit more interesting than salt."
Christ. I glanced up at the clock. Not even 8 o'clock. At this rate, we'd all be climbing the walls by midnight.
"Coke?"
Melanie said. She folded her arms as she looked coolly across at Tom, and there was a note of distaste in her voice.
"Really? We're not students anymore. Some of us are parents. I don't think pumping and dumping's going to sort that one out."
"So don't do it,"
Tom said with a shrug, but there was an edge in his voice.
"Grubs up!"
The awkward pause was broken by Flo standing in the doorway, her arms trembling beneath the weight of a huge board covered with melting pizza. There was a bottle wedged under her arm.
"Can someone clear the coffee table before I deposit this little lot all over my aunt's rug?"
"Tell you what," Claire said as she watched Nina and me make space on the table, then reached over and gave Tom a salty, citrusy kiss.
"Let's save it for dessert."
"No problem,"
Tom said lightly. He pushed the packet back in his pocket.
I've no wish to force my rather expensive drugs on people who don't appreciate them.
Melanie gave a slightly thin smile and took the bottle out from Flo's arm as she slid the tray onto the table and stood up.
Talking of champagne.
Well, it is a special occasion,
Flo said. She